I don't know what my husband and I will say to each of our children one day. I'm not sure which parts of our story we might each choose to pluck and edit out for them, and which ones we'll shuffle around and insert back in to produce a final version. Even though plucking, shuffling, and editing sounds is probably the best summary of what my husband and I do for a living. But the children will ask, because ask is what children do. And we'll need to tell them a beginning, a middle, and an end. We'll need to give them an answer, tell them a proper story. The boy turned 10 yesterday, just one day before we left New York. We got him good presents. He had specifically said, no toys. The girl is 5 and for some weeks has been asking insistently, when do I turn 6? No matter our answer, she'll find it unsatisfactory. So we usually say something ambiguous like, soon, in a few months, before you know it. The girl is my daughter and the boy is my husband's son. I'm a biological mother to one, a stepmother to the other, and a de facto mother in general to both of them. My husband is a father and a stepfather, to each one respectively, but also just a father. The girl and boy are therefore stepsister, son, stepdaughter, daughter, stepbrother, sister, stepson, brother. And because hyphenations and petty nuances complicate the sentences of everyday grammar, the us, the them, the our, the your, as soon as we started living together, when the boy was almost 6 and the girl still a toddler, we adopted the much simpler possessive adjective, our, to refer to them too. They became our children, and sometimes the boy, the girl. Quickly, the two of them learned the rules of our private grammar and adopted the generic nouns mama and papa, or sometimes simply ma and pa. And until now, at least, our family lexicon defined the scope and limits of our shared world. Family plot. My husband and I met 4 years ago, recording a soundscape of New York City. We were part of a large team of people working for New York University's Center for Urban Science and Progress. The soundscape was meant to sample and collect all the keynotes and the sound marks that were emblematic of the city. Subway cars screeching to a halt, music in the long underground hallways of 42nd Street, ministers preaching in Harlem, bells, rumors, and murmurs inside the Wall Street Stock Exchange. But it also attempted to survey and classify all the other sounds that the city produced and that usually went by as noise, unnoticed. Cash registers opening and closing in delis, a script being rehearsed in an empty Broadway theater, underwater currents in the Hudson, Canada geese flocking and shitting over Van Cortlandt Park, swings swinging in Astoria playgrounds, elderly Korean women filing wealthy fingernails on the Upper West Side, a fire breaking through an old tenement building in the Bronx, a passerby yelling a stream of motherfuckers at another. There were journalists, sound artists, geographers, urbanists, writers, historians, acoustomologists, anthropologists, musicians, and even bathymetrists, with those complicated devices called multi-beam echo sounders, which were plunged into the water spaces surrounding the city, measuring the depth and contours of the riverbeds and who knows what else. Everyone, in couples or small groups, surveyed and sampled wavelengths around the city like we were documenting the last sounds of an enormous beast. The two of us were paired up and given the task of recording all the languages spoken in the city over a period of 4 calendar years. The description of our duties specified surveying the most linguistically diverse metropolis on the planet and mapping the entirety of languages that its adults and children speak. We were good at it, it turned out. Maybe even really good. We made a perfect team of 2. Then, after working together for just a few months, we fell in love, completely, irrationally, predictably, and headfirst, like a rock might fall in love with a bird, not knowing who the rock was and who the bird. And when summer arrived, we decided to move in together. The girl remembers nothing about that period, of course. The boy says he remembers that I was always wearing an old blue cardigan that had lost a couple of buttons and came down to my knees, and that sometimes, when we rode the subway or buses, always with freezing air pouring out, I'd take it off and use it as a blanket to cover him and the girl, and that it smelled of tobacco and was itchy. Moving in together had been a rash decision, messy, confusing, urgent, and as beautiful and real as life feels when you're not thinking about its consequences. We became a tribe. Then came the consequences. We met each other's relatives, got married, started filing joint taxes, became a family. Inventory. In the front seats, he and I. In the glove compartment, proof of insurance, registration, owner's manual, and roadmaps. In the back seat, the two children, their backpacks, a tissue box, and a blue cooler with water bottles and perishable snacks. And in the trunk, a small duffel bag with my Sony PCM D50 digital voice recorder, headphones, cables, and extra batteries. A large port-a-brace organizer for his collapsible boom pole, mic, headphones, cables, Zeppelin and dead cat windshield, and the 702T sound device. Also, four small suitcases with our clothes, and seven banker's boxes, 15 by 12 by 10, double-thick bottoms and solid lids.